Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
And welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. In our guidebooks, we often talk about the fact that prices rise and crowds grow at festival times. And so the advice becomes, go at another time. But the truth is, whenever I have gone to a festival, and I've had the privilege of going to the Fringe Festival and the Edinburgh Festival. I've been to the Olympics twice. I've been to other festivals. I find those are the most sublime types of travel experiences and the most eye-opening, which is why I was so excited to hear about a new book that is all about festival travel. It's called Fiesta, A Journey Through Festivity. And the author, Daniel Stables, is here now to talk with us about it. Hey, Daniel, thank you so much for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So I would say this is half a travel book and half a book of philosophy, because you dig pretty deeply into why every culture on earth has festivals. So let's talk about the travel part of it first, and we'll weave in the philosophical side of the book. How long did it take you to research this, and how many festivals did you go to?
Well, kind of on and off, this sort of draws on 10 years or so of experience. So I've been working as a travel writer for about that length of time. Yeah, I've been so lucky in the course of that career. I started off writing guidebooks, and then nowadays I write articles more for magazines. But I've been very, very privileged in that time to go to all kinds of festivals all over the world. And yeah, every time I've been lucky enough to go to one, I've always had this feeling of it's kind of like culture in its most distilled form, you know, or just even life, human experience in a very, everything's turned up to 11. And that's obviously the case in very obvious physical ways, like with costumes and sights and sounds and the smells of food and music and all these things. Also, the more festivals I went to, the more I realized kind of actually maybe there's something a little bit sort of deeper going on here, in terms of you go to places all over the world, whether it's just down the road from where I live in Manchester in England or in rural Indonesia, and you see kind of things that are similar. And that really intrigued me. And so I wanted to kind of dig into those things. But also, you know, my background is as a travel writer, and I love that kind of immediacy and that immersion that you get through travel narratives. So, yeah, so I felt like I think festivals hopefully are kind of certainly a good subject matter for the travel writing.
Oh, absolutely. And on the philosophical side, you introduce the concept of liminality. And I hope I'm pronouncing that right, because I don't think I've ever said word aloud before. And it's probably a word that some of our listeners have never heard. So let's talk about liminality and festivals.
Sure. So liminality is this idea. It comes from anthropology. And it kind of describes the state of being on a threshold or in between two stages of society. I won't go sort of too deeply into it, but it originates with a guy called Arnold van Gennep, who wrote about, he coined the term rites of passage. And so he described people who are in between various kind of stages of their lives, you know, whether that's between adolescence and adulthood or when you're graduating from college or whatever it is. When you're in these in-between states, you're in a liminal state. So in festivals, again, other there's another anthropologist called Victor Turner who elaborated on this in lots of depth in the 1970s, I think. And he specifically spoke about festivals, among other events, as kind of these events where the normal hierarchies and ways of being in society kind of get dissolved and stripped away. And suddenly everyone enters onto this like level playing field. And it engenders these very powerful feelings of what he called communitas, which is like basically just communal feelings, which strengthen societal bonds and things like that.
Yeah.
And then you go back to normal. And then the idea is, you know, that these kind of this shared experience has kind of in some way strengthened bonds between people. And yeah, it's a very powerful thing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the second place you discuss in the book, which is Venice, where people throw off the strictures of daily life by wearing masks.
That's
and
right.
I love the fact that the Venice Carnival, where people do all kinds of bawdy things, and they do them because they feel like they are anonymous thanks to their masks. This has influenced what certain geographic locations are called. So let's talk about the Bridge of Tits.
Okay, yeah.
Can you tell the story behind the Bridge of Tits? I thought that was fascinating.
Sure, yeah. So a bit of background. Yeah, Venice Carnival goes back sort of almost 1,000 years in one form or another. So effectively, like carnival celebrations across the sort of Christian world, celebrated in the week leading up to Lent. And so traditionally it was a, you know, this time of release before Lent, which was a much more somber and sort of lean period. And as you said, a Venice Carnival, everyone would wear masks. It's a perfect example of what I was just saying, this leveling power of festivals. Everybody wore a mask. And originally the masks all looked the same. It was very different from now where they're all kind of extravagant. They were just plain white masks. And so underneath that mask, it could be anybody. It could be a, you know, a pauper or a king or a cardinal or a nun. And all these people, I think, including cardinals and nuns, acted in ways which you would not necessarily expect them to during those times, because they could, because of the anonymity afforded by wearing a mask. And one of the reasons why periodically carnival has been kind of suppressed over the centuries is because it allows, that anonymity allows for criminality. And if not criminality, then behaving in ways which were frowned upon by the authorities. And so one of the kind of groups of people who were emboldened to live the way that they wanted to live, but weren't allowed to most of the time, was homosexual men. So homosexuality was illegal during the Venetian Republic, even though Venetians were kind of famous for their sexual freedom, I guess. I mean, Casanova was Venetian, after
all. Sure, right.
One of the very early variations on the plain white mask, which emerged in Venice Carnival, was the cat mask, the feline mask, which you still see at Venice Carnival today. It's called the Nyaga, and that name is onomatopoeic. It comes from the sound of a cat's meow, supposedly.
Oh.
And one of the really interesting things about masquerade in general, and you see this not only in Venice Carnival, but in other examples of festivals across the world, cultures across the world, there's this idea that, at least historically, when you put on a mask like that, they weren't just sort of deemed to be, oh, they've just, that is just that person wearing a mask. It's actually like they've taken on the role and the personality of the mask that they're wearing. So at Venice Carnival, one of the effects of this was that if you were wearing a certain mask, you kind of were judged by the standards of that character that the mask represented. And so the feline cat mask was considered to be a feminine role. And so the reason gay men wore it was because if they then had gay affairs during that time, they were deemed technically not to have had a gay affair because they were kind of considered to be women because they were wearing that costume. It's kind of hard for us to get our heads around.
Fascinating, yeah.
In the modern age. So it's kind of like a loophole. And so there's a bridge in Venice called the Ponte delle Tette, which means the Bridge of Tits. And legend has it that Venice's male prostitutes were so emboldened by this loophole in the law that happened during carnival time. They were getting so much business that the city's female prostitutes began to go out of business. And so they appealed to help from the Bishop of Venice, funnily enough.
Right.
Who said to them, okay, to sort of boost business, I'll allow you to flaunt your wares, if you like, in public, in this very specific part of the city, which was this bridge, which was in the red light district. And so they were allowed to stand topless on this bridge, and hence it became known as the Bridge of Tits.
Yeah,
and it is known that way to this day.
Incredible. So that was one of the masks, the feline mask. You also talk about the fact that a plague doctor mask was always big during Carnival. And in fact, often celebrations dig deep into themes of death and decay and disease. And you've seen this come back since COVID, right? That this seems to be something that you're seeing at many festivals nowadays.
Particularly. So when I went to Venice Carnival, it was 2023. And so it was the second year that it had come back. And absolutely, the plague doctor mask was out in full swing. There was actually a couple of characters doing like a comedy skit around the city where there was a guy in the plague doctor mask, and then there was someone dressed as a COVID-19 virus, and there was like the plague doctor was chasing him around. I went to an atelier where they make traditional masks, and they said that the plague doctor mask has become even more popular than normal in the years since COVID. I mean, obviously, partly it's just like, you know, gallows humor.
Sure.
Which is absolutely a feature of carnival parades and festivals across the world. But it's also this feeling of part of the kind of power of festivals and part of the kind of impetus behind why they are the way they are, in these kind of explosions of uninhibited behavior, doing stuff, behavior that sometimes would be considered transgressive, getting really drunk or using drugs or being promiscuous in some cases, or, you know, this kind of behavior seems to be allowable at festival times. And I think part of the reason for that is that their role is to serve almost as memento mori in some cases.
Right.
Partly, I mean, lots of festivals specifically have a end of life theme. But there's one in Spain, for example, where it's called translates as the Festival of Near Death Experiences. And it takes the form of a parade of coffins, which goes through this town. And inside the coffins are people who have genuinely in life survived a near-death experience, and they're in these coffins, and they get carried through the town, and then they open the coffin, they leap out, and they sort of dance around the town, and it's like a celebration of life, a victory of life over death. The festivals are good at those. They're kind of, you know, they're good on these big themes, life and death and food and birth and sex
life, death and food. And one of the most stunning parts of your book was when you talk about the festivals of the Taoists in Phuket, which is something I'd never heard of before. So can you talk about the origins of that festival and what happens at it?
Sure, yeah. So there's, in Phuket, as you say, in Thailand, there's a festival called the Nine Emperor Gods Festival, or the Phuket Vegetarian Festival is what it's most commonly known as, which sounds pretty, you know, wholesome. Maybe just some meat-free food and an early night. But it's actually one of the most kind of incredible, bizarre, and actually kind of gory festivals that you can imagine. So it's held over 9 days in the ninth lunar month of the year, which is normally in September or October. And its origins are in the 1820s, I think, with a touring opera group from southern China who were on tour in Phuket, and they got caught up in an epidemic of, it was either cholera or maybe malaria. It's kind of a bit sketchy on the details, but they'd been a bit lax on their religious practices from back home. They were Taoists, as you say. And so they decided to resume them. And those religious practices included abstaining from meat, hence vegetarian festival, also abstaining from alcohol, sex, but also practicing these acts of self-mortification. So they would put skewers through their cheeks, and they'd walk on hot coals, things like that. And so they did it, and they seemed to emerge unscathed from the epidemic. So they went home, and then, but ever since, their legacy has kind of remained on Phuket through there's a big Chinese community in Phuket as well. So through them and in the Chinese shrines on Phuket, they've kept alive this festival, which has over the years become, particularly in terms of the self-mortification, become much, much more elaborate.
Yeah. You said Hieronymus Bosch would wince at some of the things you saw there, which I thought was beautifully put statement, like a man with a table lamp through his cheek.
Yeah. Swords, table lamps. There was a guy with a BMX sort of bike frame through his face. Like the kind of life-changing body modifications. I mean, not that they walk around year round with table lamps through their face, but you know, you see people who are old hands at it. They've been doing it for years and just huge, massive scars. And there was one guy actually who I chatted to who's been doing it for 20 odd years. I was talking to him the day after he had done. So they did these processions every day with the things in their faces. And I was talking to him the day after he had done his. So his face was just covered in bandages. And I said, how long have you been doing this for? And he said, oh, 25 years, except during COVID. I'm not stupid. So they do have some limits.
Well, the reasons they do it, you interviewed one of these. They're called Moivans or what's
Masong, they're called.
Masong.
Yeah.
And they, during adolescence, they feel they are chosen by a god, and it's different gods. I thought this was also fascinating because of the pluralistic religions on the island of Phuket. It's not just Taoism. You know, sometimes people are doing this in honor of Hindu gods. Sometimes they're doing it in honor of other gods, and they dress in different costumes to show honor to those gods. And I'm a unrepentant atheist. So part of me thought, did these people have psychological breaks in adolescence? And is this something that their culture has been able to make part of the fabric of life there? I mean, in adolescence, that's often when people get schizophrenia. So I was wondering if, and that's a very Western and probably terrible thing to bring into this, but trances as they do this, right? I mean, tell a little bit about the person you talk to and their experience of doing this.
Yeah, it's fascinating to witness, especially from, you know, I'm like you, I come at this from a kind of secular Western perspective, and I'm fascinated by religion, but I'm not religious, and I view it as a human kind of cultural phenomenon. So yeah, I interviewed a lady who had, again, she'd been doing it for, I think 20 odd years. She was in her 40s. And she had, as you say, been chosen, as she put it, by in her adolescence by a deity. So as she described it, and this I think is quite a common kind of pattern, these people will have various problems in their, normally in adolescence, in their younger lives. They describe it as a kind of spiritual sickness, but it manifests in physical ways. So lots of illnesses. She said she had lots of near-death experiences as well, lots of accidents. And then one day she woke up and had kind of passed out, and she woke up, and in her hand, she was holding a piece of paper, and on the piece of paper was written something in Chinese lettering. And she didn't speak Chinese languages, so she didn't understand what it said. But she went to the Chinese shrine and they translated it for her. And it was the name of the deity that had chosen her, because they, like most of these deities, still come from the Chinese pantheon. Although, as you say, they've all mixed with Hindu and Phuketian kind of folk, Thai folk gods and stuff like that. But she said that after that, so she realized that the reason for all her problems had been because she hadn't yet kind of been in communion with her deity. And that now that she had, she had to go through a period of training. She had an aunt, it runs in the family, she said. So she had an aunt who was also a Masong. And so she trained her to be able to kind of control these periods of possession and these trances. And then now, periodically at these festival times, and she will enter the trance. And I chatted to her originally. So on the morning of the procession, they go to the shrine, which is where they have the piercings done. And this lady, Kaiwali, she was called, her piercings were very traditional, let's say, subtle, just a skewer through each cheek. I was talking to her at the temple beforehand, and she was just completely, she was dressed in these amazing festival clothes, like blue sort of tunic and stuff. But apart from that, she was just perfectly normal, just having a normal conversation. And then suddenly we stopped talking to her, left her to it. And then she suddenly started sort of retching, bending double, shaking. And then my guide translator was saying to me, she's entering her trance now. And there was like hundreds of these people doing a similar state around. when they're in the trance, they're suddenly like their eyes are all vacant and they're like shaking like jelly. It's really, it's yeah. odd. And then you see them getting the piercings, and there's no anesthetic involved.
Wow.
And I think, again, it's just probably a testament to the power of the human brain, the power of trance states. And it's really interesting how they all seem to act in the exact same way, all these people, mm-hmm. when they're in this trance. Also, with the linguistic thing is really interesting, because she, like, as I said, she received this name of this god, which she supposedly had written down in a trance despite not speaking the language. And she said that when she's in the trance and she's possessed by the deity, she speaks this language, which is Hokkien Chinese, which is from the south of China, which she claims to ordinarily not understand at all.
Right.
And this is kind of, it harks back to this, it's called glossolalia, this phenomenon of speaking in languages you don't normally understand. It harks back almost to like Victorian times and spirit mediumship, and like most of which was just a complete con.
No, it was fascinating. I love the fact that she works as a guide normally, and her company gave her time off to be a part of this ritual. You write, because it's deemed to bring good karma to the company and to wider society. This is the whole point of the self-mutilation practices, Kaweli explained. The Masungs suffer for the rest of our sins, taking on the bad karma of the community, which, you know, I'm not Christian. It reminded me of Christianity. Yeah. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah. It's really interesting, these parallels. And they kind of don't really see it as, I mean, they almost see it as like an honor, where they're chosen, as they see it, to be a Masung, but also it's kind of a burden, not least because you have to mutilate yourself for ritual purposes.
Now you start the book in the Shetland Islands, where for an entire year, it sounds like, people build these very detailed, very beautiful replicas of Viking ships. And then at this festival celebrating the end of winter, they're set ablaze. That too is a common thing at festivals, where the temporariness of life is brought to the fore, right?
Yeah, totally.
What's so interesting about the Shetland Festival is you think of it as being part of Scotland, but in a certain way, they have more in common with Scandinavia, right?
That's right, yeah. So Shetland, the archipelago of the Shetland Islands, is kind of way, way north, in the middle of the North Sea, between Scotland, mainland Scotland, and Scandinavia, effectively. If you talk to people there, they will tell you that they feel more Scandinavian than Scottish, certainly more Scandinavian than British. And kind of there's a genetic basis for that. The genetic studies have been done on these people, and they are much more Scandinavian than most mainland Scottish people. But also because of where the islands are, you know, historically they've been a crossroads for Vikings and people going to the Americas, and so they're kind of their own thing, really. They're not, you know, they're Shetlandic, if you like, but they feel, yeah. Someone told me there that they'd be more likely to put up a Norwegian flag for their national day than they would a Scottish flag for St. Andrew's Day. Yeah, they have the festival's called Uphelliar. It's actually a series of festivals. I think there's 12 of them, and they're held between kind of January and March, and it coincides with the old festival of Yule, the end of Yule, which was this kind of, you know, pre-Christian wintertime festival. And the main one is the one that I go to in the book, which is in the capital of the Shetland Islands, which is a town called Lerwick. They don't quite spend all year building it, but they spend all winter building these boats, the galley, as they call it. And it's just all volunteers and locals. And they build these beautiful things, like proper reconstructions of old Viking longships, huge, huge things, painted beautifully with dragons on the prows and stuff. And then they spend all this time and all this money and all this effort building these things, only to ritualistically destroy them, set them alight. And you see it a lot in festivals, like you say. I liken it in the book to the sand mandala, which is the Tibetan Buddhist thing, these sand artworks made from colored sand, and they're so intricate and elaborate, but the whole point of them building them is to destroy them, to represent the transience of life and all this stuff. And
Guatemala once for Easter festivities, and they create these extraordinary rugs over the parade route using petals from flowers.
Yes.
And they spend hours. We actually got to help, you know, painstakingly creating these rugs out of petals, and they've spent months raising money to buy the flowers and to bring them in from the mountains. And, you know, we spent hours putting these petals in incredibly intricate patterns, and then they were destroyed in seconds as the parade marched through. And it's a very emotional experience to see it and to be part of it.
I think it's interesting as well, like talking to local, because so I put it to one of the locals when we were watching the galley emerge from this huge hangar shed that had been in all winter, this huge moment. And I mentioned that thing about it being like a sand mandala. And then one of the locals just sort of like said, like in a slightly dismissive way, was like, there's just nothing else to do around here all winter. as if I was completely over and, you know, over intellectualizing it. But I think sometimes, you know, one of the things that's interesting and fun about experiencing these things in lots of different cultures, as well as our own, is that with stuff close to home, often we don't really think about why we do it or realize why we do it. I mean, I think of, you know, Christmas, Easter, like the stuff, the ones that we're used to, the cultural festivals that we're used to, we don't really give it much thought.
Right.
And so it's kind of nice sometimes to have an outsider's perspective when you get into these things. With Up Heliar, it was like, traditionally it's the end of winter. So it's like the light maybe is just about to come back. So obviously fire is another big symbolic thing.
Sure. And firecrackers and all kinds of drinking. And
yeah. Fireworks and a lot of drinking. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's a big, big party. Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing they definitely have in common with the Scots and probably, I guess, the Scandinavians as well. But yeah, they definitely like a drink and they definitely see in the new year that way in a big way. But it's kind of a real, having all these symbols of renewal and, you know, burning away the cares of the old year. It's kind of a nice symbolic thing to have as a New Year's festival.
I think. As the person said to you, there's nothing else to do here. He was saying it's about the festival, perhaps not the symbols. And the only icky festival that you cover, to my mind icky, was Burning Man, where everybody seemed incredibly aware of the symbolism and doing things because of the symbolism, which made it feel very precious and somewhat phony, at least from the way you wrote about it in the book.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I have to say, I can't speak from personal experience with Burning Man, because when I talk about it in the book, it's I was kind of planning on doing a chapter set at Burning Man, couldn't get a ticket. So it was for a chapter of the book where I talk about, I try and look at this question of whether festivals can kind of change society, you know, whether they, because lots of festivals like Burning Man, there's a kind of category of festival where they present themselves as being kind of laboratories for like new ways of living and for trying out. So Burning Man claims to, you know, it says it's like, we don't have cash. It's all about cooperation and you can only trade things and you have to participate in a spirit of what they call radical self-reliance, where you build your own camps and all that stuff, which is fine. But the fact is that there's
flying in on private jets and they're paying.
It has its own private airport. Yeah. Has its own private airport for the billionaires to fly in, and they pay their way into pre-erected camps and stuff. And they do these supposedly satirical artworks, which are supposed to be criticisms of the oil industry, but they're fire installations and they are fueled with thousands of gallons of jet fuel and liquid propane. And so it's just Burning Man. I mean, Burning Man is almost, it's like an easy target, you know, because it's such a kind of, everyone knows how ridiculous it is.
Sure.
I ended up going much more low key for my reported narrative in that festival, which was to go to a festival in Wales, which is called Green Gathering, which is actually a great little festival. And it's about, kind of workshops in how to fit solar panels to your house or how to, just be more sustainable in a bit of a more genuine sort of way. But,
well, the book takes you everywhere. I mean, there are pilgrimages in it. There are religious processions. There's the equinox at a megalithic tomb on the island of Malta. I mean, you really bring festivals around the world to life. So thank you so much for the great conversation and the great read.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I, I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.